For the week of February 26th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 357, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Lots of news this week. Beyonce is not performing at Coachella, as you wisely predicted last week when you saw she looked about 10 months pregnant at the Grammy Awards.
Yes, indeed. I think, you know, it's funny that we're starting off with like Beyonce news and Coachella, since the Grammys, you know, that's when we saw how pregnant she was. That was, what, 2 weeks ago? And now this week we're going to be talking about something else, another award ceremony.
Anyway, whatever we talk about, people from Japan will not be listening because they're reading Haruki Murakami's new novel. It just came out in Japan last week in two volumes set. It's called Killing Commendatore, Killing Commendatore. That's a vague English translation. It's his first novel in 4 years. As is typical with Murakami, his plot is not revealed in advance, but it is being printed in two volumes. The first volume they've printed 700,000 copies, and the second volume they've printed 600,000 copies. I'm not sure why they think someone would want to read the first volume and not the second. Wouldn't you just buy both at the same time? I guess the idea is maybe 100,000 people will just give up and stop.
I guess. I don't know. If I were Murakami, I think I'd say, hey, what do you think? People aren't going to want to read the second one? Come on.
Yes,
have a little faith in me.
Hugely popular in Japan. It's exciting to have a novelist, a literary novelist, whose work is greeted with excitement. So that's fun to see in Japan. And of course, I'm sure everyone in America is waiting for our show. And what will they hear about on this week's episode?
Well, it depends on whether they're going to hear about the first thing we thought or you know, afterwards somebody else will come along and say, actually, we should have talked about something else.
Yes, and keep going.
Okay. Well, speaking of Anne, I know you said and, but still, on this week's Showbiz Sandbox, we'll be joined by Anne Thompson, who will hopefully be able to explain just what the heck happened last night during the Academy Awards ceremony. I'm still trying to calm down over it. If you haven't heard by now, La La Land was the big winner, taking home 6 awards except for the top prize of the night, which it also won, at least for 3.5 minutes before it was announced Moonlight had won Best Picture. And we'll take us backstage at the Oscars. The Spirit Awards were also held over the weekend, along with the Césars in France, so we'll touch on those as well. During our book filter segment, Oi, does Michael have a mystery series for you? On Inside Baseball, we'll once again talk about the ongoing negotiations between Hollywood studios and cinema owners to shorten the release window, enabling new movies to hit homes sooner, but at a much higher price. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. We have a link to them in our show notes, but we also pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit, the New York Times, the LA Times, everyone but Price Waterhouse. Oh. And the number one movie around the world is Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, because it opened in Japan. This is why Hollywood is excited by Japan. It's the second biggest opener of all time in China. It's the biggest is Lost in Hong Kong. So it's not just the biggest Western movie. It's the biggest, second biggest movie, period. It grossed $97 million over the weekend, taking a movie that had grossed about $140 million to $240 million in one weekend. It is playing in 51 territories, but $94 million of that money all came from China. So that's a huge, huge opening. It almost makes it profitable in that one weekend in China alone, because the budget for Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, is about $40 million. And you can be certain of one thing, the name of the movie is a lie.
What do you mean, the name of the...
Because it made $100 million in China, there will be a final chapter.
Okay, I see what you're saying. It's not the Resident Evil part you have a problem with. You think it's the final chapter.
The final chapter, yeah. Not when you make $100 million on your opening weekend in China. At number two around the world is the Lego Batman movie. $31 million over the weekend. $230 million just about worldwide. And number three is Get Out, the Jordan Peele horror flick. Jordan Peele, whose middle name is Ki Hu. It's a movie with a vague racial overtones to it. That's sort of the cool hip factor that they're using to sell the movie. It's from Blumhouse, the producers that just did Split, the M. Night Shyamalan movie a few weeks ago. So that movie cost about $10 million to make and was a big hit. This movie cost $5 million to make. It doubled that gross on opening day. That's how well it's done. Opening weekend is $30 million just from North America alone. We'll have to see how it plays overseas. But Get Out is a great example of why you should not get too excited by the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Why is that?
Because it's got 100% rating, as if it's the best movie of all time. People go, oh my God, it has 100% rating. Again, the Rotten Tomatoes score is basically an up or down vote. If every critic in the world says it's okay, it gets 100%. If half the critics say it's a masterpiece and the other half say it's a disaster, then it gets 50%, which means a masterpiece like Blue Velvet or any Stanley Kubrick film might well get a 60 or 70 if it had been around during the Rotten Tomatoes days. While a movie like Get Out, which most people thought was pretty good, some people thought was very good, but most thought was pretty good, that can get 100%. But because all Rotten Tomatoes says is yes or no, that means despite a raft of 2.5 out of 4 stars, the movie has a 100% rating. So stop quoting Rotten Tomatoes as if it means a movie is a masterpiece because everybody said it doesn't suck.
So, okay, so what you're saying is that sometimes voting systems or you know, these aggregated counts don't actually add up to anything. Okay, just ask Hillary Clinton about that.
But anyway, just, you know, let's please stop taking Rotten Tomatoes scores of 80, 90, 100% as if it means something. It can, but it doesn't necessarily. And you know what? All the reviews of Get Out were pretty good. They all said, hey, it's interesting. It's kind of good. Some people loved it. But, you know, it is not the best reviewed movie of the year. Lego Batman Movie, which is a lower Rotten Tomatoes score, but still a high one. That's a much better reviewed film. At number 4 around the world, going back to the grosses, is 50 Shades Darker. $27 million over the weekend, $330 million worldwide. At number 5 is The Great Wall, the Matt Damon movie that Jimmy Kimmel hilariously made fun of, $23 million over the weekend, and that has passed the $300 million mark worldwide.
Now, what I want to know is, okay, the budget was pretty high, $150 million, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's made $300 million worldwide, okay? So when Jimmy Kimmel, during the Oscars, says, hey, you lost $80 million. No, you may have lost $80 million here in the United States, but it didn't even open in the United States first. So it's obviously doing quite well worldwide.
Well, we assume a movie like this probably has to triple its budget to be considered a clear box office winner. It doesn't mean if it doesn't do that, it won't, you know, be profitable for everyone involved. But it's only double its budget. It's a big budget. So yeah, I would say it's lost money worldwide. Right now, if it stopped today at $300 million, we would think it had lost maybe $80 million or something. You know, there's more money to be made down the road. We know that. But right now, it is not a big winner. There's no question about that. Will it end up at $450 million? Maybe. It's in 47 territories. It's made $23 million this weekend, so it's not that slowing down. I'm not sure what big territories it has left. Has it opened in Japan? Are there other big Asian territories where we think it'll have a big impact? Or countries where Matt Damon's a big draw. It's played in the two biggest territories. It did pretty well in China, matching its budget, and it did pretty poorly in North America, where it's only made $35 million. Not a very good score for a big action blockbuster would be like this one. Compare that to John Wick Chapter 2, $22 million over the weekend and $125 million worldwide. It's already a hit because we think the budget's about $40 million, and it has tripled that, and it's still going strong. And number 7 is Split, the Blumhouse film. A great couple weeks for that company. But talk about overreacting. Someone said, oh my God, Blumhouse is like the Pixar of horror films. You know, calm down. Two movies that are hits in 2 weeks. Let's not start comparing them to one of the greatest runs in creative and blockbuster history.
Well, anyway. And they have, you know, look, they did the Paranormal series. They did the Pledge series. You know, they're quite
Paranormal
good.
The Paranormal is not a good movie, though.
Yeah, that's
Pixar's are acclaimed as one of the great, you know, great films of all time. Almost all of them for like 8 or 9 or 10 years were brilliant.
Right. And what you're saying is don't equate financial success with critical and artistic success.
And don't equate two hits in a row with like 15 years in a row. You know, yeah. I mean, Pixar had a run of commercial and mostly critical success that was truly remarkable. It's paused now, but it was remarkable. Blumhouse isn't remotely within that vein, but more power to them. Cheap horror flicks and they're making money. They made $20 million over the weekend with Split, and they're at $220 million worldwide. And number 8 is the Oscar hopeful La La Land, which won a lot of awards, 6 awards over the night, best actress, the youngest man to ever win best director. They should all be happy. $19 million over the weekend, $370 million worldwide. Looking at La La Land and Hidden Figures, which is a little bit lower down, that one made $11 million over the weekend and $180 million worldwide so far. Hopefully they will be playing Hidden Figures in a lot of territories. It's in 42 right now, and they've made $30 million overseas. But the one thing that was interesting about both these movies, when we get to the shortening the window of movies down at the end of the show, when we talk in Inside Baseball, Hidden Figures has its release dates for DVD and Blu-ray of April 11th. La La Land hasn't even announced a release date yet. These are movies that they saw as long-running films. They're still making great money all over the world. Why rush it out onto Blu-ray? Why rush it to streaming?
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean, that film opened in January. Hidden Figures opened wide in January.
Hidden Figures did, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a three-month window. It probably could have stood a 4 or 5 month window easily.
At number nine is Assassin's Creed, which I assume perhaps has opened in China. I'm not sure where it's playing new this weekend. It looks like, according to a Box Office Mojo, that it did open on like the 24th. They didn't have full weekend figures, but it made $17 million somewhere. Obviously, that was dwarfed by the number one movie in China, which was our number one winner, Resident Evil, The Final Chapter. Clearly, they chose that one over this, but $17 million, not bad to add that to the till. $230 million worldwide for that movie. And number 10 is Sing, the animated movie about American Idol-type hopefuls. $12 million over the weekend, $550 million worldwide.
It did open in China, by the way, on the 24th, Assassin's Creed.
That's another movie that has opened in China. I'm going to scroll right down. I have to take notes down at the bottom of our show about what movies are opening in China. And right now, my notes show that we have about 14 films and counting opened or 14 films counting that are opened or scheduled to open through early March. So clearly they are blowing past
you're talking about the import quota, right?
About the import quota that China has had in years past.
34 imported films into China every year.
And we're at 40, and it's March. You know, it's March that we're talking about through March 24th. They already have 14 films opened or scheduled to open. So that is a big sea change. We'll have to see how far that goes. At number 12 is another Oscar hopeful that got a lot of good attention, Lion. It made $10 million over the weekend, and it's about to pass $100 million worldwide. XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, made another $8 million. That's at $330 million worldwide. Looking down for some new stories, Alibi.com, that's a French comedy that opened last week. It had a great hold. It made $5.3 million over the weekend. It's made $16 million so far. And I think now we know its budget is about $6.5 million. So that one is going to edge into profitability. We also talked about the Turkish comedy Recep İvedik 5. It's a lowbrow comedy, as somebody on Wikipedia pointed out. They said all the intellectuals hate this movie, but it's hugely popular. And what I didn't realize was that it's co-written and starring Sahan Gökbakar, and it's directed by his little brother, Togan. So that's kind of cool. The whole series they've sort of done together. And this weekend it made $5 million, and that's at $16 million worldwide. Another opening is Rock Dog. This opened up in, I think, North America and flopped. This is an animated film. It was a Chinese-American co-production. It's based on a graphic novel by a rock star in China called Jun Zheng, and it's made $4 million over this weekend here in the U.S. It got caught in this big studio battle or distributor battle in China, so it sort of kind of never really opened big there. Wanda only opened it on 6 screens or 7 screens. It has gotten pretty poor reviews, but nonetheless, $4 million this weekend, $12 million total for a movie we think cost $60 million. It might have been one of those co-productions that sort of fell through the cracks, you know? It wasn't Chinese enough, and it wasn't American enough. It was sort of that Euro pudding that we heard about for many years when they tried to do co-productions in Europe. And looking down, we have one more movie that opened up, Guardians. This is a Russian superhero movie, Zaschitniki in Russian, perhaps. It is set during the Cold War, and it's sort of a Soviet-era throwback. It features a team of superheroes, each one coming from a different sort of Soviet territory, once controlled by that empire, and they're all banding together to fight a supernatural forces attacking the Soviet Union and the world. And I guess if the evil corporate overlords of the West get crushed in the bargain, well, that'll be okay too. but it has characters like Landman, who's Armenian, and Wildman, who's a bear, and Windman, who's sort of Asian, and Water Woman. So it's got all these sort of elemental vibes and different areas of Russia and the Soviet Union so that everybody can root for their own superhero. And it's directed and produced by Sarik Andreasyan and his production company. I love this. It's called Enjoy Movies. That's what everyone should say. Enjoy Movies. And it opened up in Russia and it's in three territories. It made $3.3 million on its opening weekend.
I don't know who the head of Enjoy Movies is, but I do know Enjoy Movies is what you're supposed to be doing when you are watching Academy Award-winning films. And here to talk about this year's Academy Award-winning films, all of them, not just some of them, is Anne Thompson, editor-at-large at IndieWire. Anne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm a little bleary-eyed. If I don't make sense, that's why.
Well, wait a second. The awards ceremony didn't make sense, so what's the difference?
Well, Anne, I was going to start with a little joke. I was going to say, hey, the big awards were handed out last night. And, of course, as we all know, Elle won Best Picture and Isabelle Huppert won Best Actress. And in a big surprise, Xavier Dolan won Best Director. And then we'd say, oh, ha-ha, I'm talking about the César Awards instead of the Oscars. But today, it's not really funny to pretend you've messed up which award with which person.
No, it's one of the great Oscar gaffes of all time. I mean, there is a precedent for it. There was a Sammy Davis Jr. Snafu where he got the wrong envelope and everything. But it really was crazy. I was backstage. And it was a good year to be backstage because, of course, Emma Stone came back and went, was that crazy or what? And she loved Moonlight and was raving about Moonlight. And, I think in a way, a lot of people were rooting for Moonlight, clearly. It sent a message that was what the Oscar voters wanted to send in this particular moment in time. I always doubted, I predicted that La La Land would win because, of course, all the signs were pointing to that. But I always doubted the inevitability of that win.
Well, it seems a shame if everybody decides this is a political vote rather than simply that this is the film they love the most.
I don't think it's like that. I think it's more a question of the dovetailing of love the most with this is who we are. This is what we represent. This is what we believe in. It's sort of like the 12 Years a Slave vote. It's a similar thing. And it isn't just, I mean, if you looked at all the signs that year, it would have gone another way. It wasn't, and Spotlight too, if you like, this is what we believe in. And these are the values finally La La Land simply didn't have enough gravitas. It didn't have that je ne sais quoi that aligned with the zeitgeist, and Moonlight did. All right. So as far as the gaffe part of it, basically, there were some people backstage, there were some people on the stage, there were some people I spoke to in the course of the evening last night. There were people who came back to the press room, there were people at the governor's ball. And what I have patched together is that Warren Beatty was handed a red envelope that was the wrong envelope. He looked at it, he was nonplussed, it said Emma Stone, La La Land. He, Faye Dunaway, I mean, I've done the same thing everyone else has done, which is to sort of obsessively look at the videotape, and she looks at it and she says what she sees. She just reads what she sees. She says it's La La Land, right?
Right, because she's looking for the name of a movie. She sees the name of a movie. She says the name of the movie.
And then, the part that sort of confuses me there is why Warren sort of nodded and smiled at that point, as if it was out of his hands. He didn't read it.
Didn't, but I think he was looking around trying to get something. He was confused, looking around going, what's going on? This doesn't make sense. And I think perhaps he was just showing it to her to say, no, look, it's the wrong envelope.
Right.
They're older people. They didn't do it. It's an obvious mistake. If you look at the screen grab, as everyone knows, he was handed the other duplicate Best Actress, you know, envelope. They have one on each side of the stage, as we all know.
That's right. There's two sets of them. There always are two sets of them. The Pricewaterhouse people have this for that very reason. But somebody, if Leonardo DiCaprio handed Emma Stone her best actress, and she said backstage, "I'm hanging on to my card. I have it." You know, she has the card.
Because there's two of them.
Second card. So the second card came from the other side of the stage, and it was a mistake. Someone handed Warren the wrong card. So they went and hunted for the right one. They found it. They figured out they got the wrong thing. It took 2 minutes. Three producers from La La Land giving their acceptance speeches. And then Jordan Horowitz gets a lot of credit for being graceful under pressure, for doing the right thing, for doing it in a gracious way. And Barry Jenkins backstage thanked the La La Land team for being gracious. And at the governor's ball, I was there when Barry Jenkins went up to Jordan Horowitz and gave him a really long hug. And his wife, Julia Hart, was there and said she was so proud of him for behaving as well as he did. The other Moonlight producer, Adele Romansky, came up and hugged him. The other one, Jeremy Kleiner, came up. They all felt bad because that horrible moment, you can see the picture of Damien Chazelle just shell-shocked and horrified. There was a joke on Twitter that this was the, you know, the origin of a superhero villain. You
know? That's actually quite funny.
But this really was a disaster because it kind of spoils everybody's moment. It spoils everybody's night. And I wonder what it was like at the parties, and everybody was just, were they down? Were they unhappy? Was it just an unpleasant end of the rest of the evening?
The La La Land party was awake. I mean, it was bad. And over at the governor's ball, Don Hudson, the CEO of the Academy, was livid.
Of course.
Yeah,
fuming,
I mean, well, because
furious.
Think about it. You've got one job. You do one thing all year. And I realize that she's got more than one job. But I mean, this is a reflection on the Academy itself.
I don't agree. I think it's a reflection on PricewaterhouseCoopers. And that's how she sees it. She's definitely passing the blame.
I'm sure she does. But I feel like it was symbolic. Obviously, somebody at Pricewaterhouse handed over the wrong envelope. But you know what? This is what happens, to my feeling, when, I mean, the whole show was a disaster to me. This is what happens when you wait to the last minute to announce the producers, and then you end up with a host that nobody wanted except ABC. You have a crappy host, a crappy show that sucked from beginning to end, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't agree with that.
Jimmy Kimmel was insulting. Like, he's making fun of black people's and people of color's names. That's his joke for the evening. Matt Damon, he made 17 jokes. He's telling Isabelle Huppert, nobody saw your movie. Oh, ha ha, that's funny. It's funny to say it to Matt Damon for a big blockbuster movie once at the beginning, but five times during his monologue, he made jokes about how no one's seen Moonlight. No one has seen Elle. Oh, that's great. That's hilarious. But that's what happens when you have Beavis and Butthead hosting your show.
I think they picked him for a reason, which is that they were afraid that the show was going to be so political that it would turn off everyone in America. And they wanted, you know, the country is split. The country is in a bit of a crazy turmoil right now.
And they wanted
someone with mainstream appeal who could handle the entertainment side of it. And I think that the show is actually well produced in the sense that that opener with Justin Timberlake went really well and engaged the audience, and they were in the crowd and people were dancing, and right off the bat, I thought that the show really went well. You could quibble with Kimmel's monologue or some of his jokes, but mainly I thought it was one of the more entertaining shows. The big mistake was all of those sequences with the people loving old movies, which, by the way, I love old movies, and I applaud anyone who loves, you know, The Apartment or whatever, but it was deadly. I thought it brought the whole thing to a clunking halt.
I would agree with that. You know, certainly, look, I did not have as much of an issue with the show as Michael did. The moments that I do have an issue with have just been mentioned. The waltzing the tourists through was
for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that was ridiculously long.
It was risky, and I sort of thought that was cool that they did. I mean, I thought the various things they did with the food coming down. You know what? The Matt Damon thing was so predictable, but it's exactly what we wanted. I mean, I liked it. I enjoyed it. It was funny. I think what probably devastated Don Hudson was that what was a pretty good show, at least reasonably good show, was completely marred by this mess up at the end. And that's what's going to be remembered, and that's it's going to be they messed up, and the whole thing that they had worked on so hard for so long just came crashing down.
Well, they did not work on it hard or long because the producers weren't picked until November, which is another reason why they screwed up the In Memoriam segment and had a living person featured. There's the two different analyses of the break of the ratings overnights. One said it's a down about 4%, maybe it'll be down a little bit from last year. Another one said it looks more like it's down almost 10% from 1 year earlier. It looks like it'll possibly be the lowest rated since 2008. It's also possible it'll become the lowest rated since they've begun rating the Oscars in the early 70s, according to Nielsen. Maybe 31 million viewers.
Wow. Well, they were worried about that, too. And that's what ABC was trying to, counteract. They wanted an entertaining show, an inclusive show.
They were trying to counteract by getting Jimmy Kimmel in there, the third or fourth rated late night host.
I actually think he did a good job. I mean, I agree with some of the off-color, stuff that you said, but I actually thought he handled it. I thought he handled it okay.
That's okay, but he is not a big draw. He's the third or fourth rated host in late night television, and I wouldn't call his comments off-color. I would call them racist. Making fun of Mahershala's name on his big night is insulting. And especially in a night where you're supposed to be talking about diversity.
Well, you know, he did say he was influenced by David Letterman, right? Jimmy Kimmel said that. And the irony is that when David Letterman hosted the Oscars, he tried to make fun of Uma
Thurman.
And
he never came back.
And he never came back.
He was making fun of two powerful, world-famous women, not a man who was having his first step into the spotlight.
Now, so do you think Jimmy Kimmel comes back in?
Hell no.
Maybe have you guys looked at the reviews for this so far? I haven't got the sense that he was excoriated at all.
No, I think that after the last several years, they were just happy to have a host that kind of didn't totally tank. And, quite honestly, the show was 3.5 hours long.
Maybe it was long.
It was way too long.
That's where the bringing the folks in from outside was probably not such a great idea.
There was And what I love about,
or that section we didn't like. Those are both things that they could have done without.
They could have cut half an hour out without even blinking. They could have had the second or third wave of candy come down as they cut to commercial without talking about it. We would have just known what was going on. If they wanted to drop candy every hour. That's okay. The first time was cute. We didn't need to hear about it the second or third. They could have just done it. We could have seen it while they were cutting to commercial.
The musical numbers were really good.
Yes, actually.
I loved the La La Land one. I thought that was beautifully produced.
And Justin Timberlake's, you mentioned that
incredible.
He started it with Can't Stop the Feeling.
And he started lip syncing to Can't Stop the Feeling. And then when he cut to live, when he got on stage and tried to sing It's a Lovely Day, I don't know why we're singing a Bill Withers song. I get the fact that it's Oscar, so it's a lovely day for Oscar, but I'm not quite sure why you're segueing into that. And he didn't sound good when he was singing that live. Hmm. He sounded a little flat.
I thought it was fine, but
you were emphasizing how much he was lip syncing when he walked up the aisle because suddenly you heard, oh, now he's singing.
Yeah.
Energetic was what I would say. It was an energetic show.
Yeah.
Except for some of some of these shows have been so epically bad that this one felt like a working one for me.
God, it was 4 hours long.
What I love about our show, though, is that we don't even have to say what we're talking about or what happened that La La Land was announced as Best Picture, but in the end it was Moonlight because everybody's actually seen it. So
all obsessively watched the video.
Right.
So basically this woman, Rebecca Keegan from Vanity Fair was backstage. So she witnessed the stage hands, the people that went onto the stage, you saw them,
Friendly.
And Jordan Horowitz.
I was like, what's going on?
Because I asked him at the governor's ball, he said that, he was aware that there were these people running around and they were taking the card and looking at the card and everything. And so he finally went up and made the announcement that just, looking at the pictures of the reactions in the house and everything, it's just enjoyable. I hate to say it. I feel bad for the people who made La La Land, who thought they won Best Picture. So I saw Chazelle at the end of the night. He was leaving the La La Land party. very downbeat. You know, there was not a celebratory feel at that party.
And were the moonlighting people feeling celebratory, or did they feel a little muted as well?
I think it did mute their win. I think, first of all, they didn't get to say all the things they were going to say. They
right.
had speeches prepared, but they didn't get to give them. And it wasn't about Moonlight. It wasn't about why Moonlight won. I think that's the story that's getting buried right now.
Yep.
Well, okay. Let's talk about that for a second, because I'm gonna kind of roll us back just a tiny bit and kind of start talking about some of the awards that were given for La La Land. We have editing. All of the music, of course, original song for City of Stars and the original score, director for Damien Chazelle, Emma Stone won Best Actress. And I guess I look at this and go, wow, so it has the best music, the best editing, the best directing, some of the best acting of the year, but it's not the best picture.
So why is that?
So why is that? And I, of course, that brings us to preferential balloting, something I hate, by the way. I hate that kind of, and it's kind of like the Electoral College, where it's, if it's raining on Tuesday in Cleveland on the even side of the street, then you win. You know, it's like, I'm not saying that Moonlight wasn't, you know, the most selected film or voted for film. I'm just saying that it does seem kind of odd that it's La La Land, La La Land, La La Land. Oh, Moonlight.
No, I don't agree. If you look back, the picture and director have split a lot in recent years. So you have Ang Lee with Life of Pi not winning Best Picture. You have Alfonso Cuarón with Gravity not winning Best Picture. And you have 6 wins for out of 10 nominations for Mad Max. It threw all the crafts and everything else, but it doesn't go on to win Best Picture. So I think La La Land falls in the category of the movie with the most scale and scope. And it shared some of the technical prizes with Hacksaw Ridge, which was the other movie of scale and scope, along with Arrival, which didn't end up winning anything except
the sound,
for
sound editing.
Sound, right. So basically, you have a situation where the movie that captured people's hearts and represented who they wanted to be and how they wanted to present their industry to the world at this particular moment in time was the winner, even though it only had 3 wins.
And you know, Anna, you said that in your IndieWire article, and I agree with you completely, because it feels like, if you had a compromise consensus second or third ballot choice, it wouldn't be Moonlight. That feels like a passionate choice, whereas maybe Hidden Figures might have been the second or third on everyone's ballot, and that might have felt like a compromise feel-good movie. Moonlight is art.
Right, and it had 8 nominations, which is why I never bought the Hidden Figures is going to steal it narrative, because it was so obvious that, you know, for a $1.5 million movie that was shot on the fly, you know, with a cast of not very well-known actors, you know, with all black cast, you know, to end up where it did is amazing.
About a young gay black drug dealer. I mean, it's the most independent win since Marty, if not The Hurt Locker.
That's where you're going, or Rocky, if you like.
Well, okay, but the examples you gave are all from the last,
or Spotlight even.
Right. Okay. So Spotlight to me is one of those moments where it really was kind of nobody. I can't imagine everybody said the number one movie of the year is Spotlight. I think it was more like the number two movie, and that you had The Big Short and Revenant kind of splitting that vote, and
Iñárritu took director because that was the bigger, flashier, if you like, movie, and a lot of us were predicting Best Picture for that because we just didn't know if it was going to go Spotlight, you know, but it did, and it's the same principle.
So, okay, but the examples you gave were all from when this preferential balloting started, if you've noticed.
It's true.
And so it used to
but
be.
But I think they go with, I'm just saying, director is one thing. It's like the best made movie, right? It's the one that was directed the best. And then best picture is the movie that represents Hollywood this year in the zeitgeist.
And you don't think it has anything to do with the fact that all of a sudden, I mean, it used to be best director was almost always the best picture. And ever since preferential balloting came along, and maybe this is what they were trying to do by shaking it up a little bit, all of a sudden
If you had me telling the Academy what to do, I'd say go back to 5 pictures and 5 directors. Give me a break and get rid of preferential balloting. I couldn't agree more.
I'd say give me 10 movies because I think you can easily fill up 10 movies a year. Why not?
I don't agree with that. If they're going to go with a longer list, they sort of have to do the preferential balloting. They explained it to me a couple of times over. It has to do with making sure that what people really like is reflected in the final tally.
Well, do you think they had an impact on the campaigning and the parties that were held to promote movies this year? We had a last minute film. One particular person was removed from nomination because they campaigned for their movie. They were calling up members in their guild to say, hey, go see my movie.
There was a song guy that was eliminated for that reason a few years ago, maybe last year, too. These things do happen.
But did you feel like they had an impact on campaigning and parties? Was it less lavish this year than in recent years?
No, what you have is the I would say not. It was they campaigned lavishly and hard during phase one, and then phase two is always a little quieter. But they're not allowed to in phase two, so it's always like coming up with a good excuse for a Q&A or something, you know, or a DVD release or something like that. No, because I exhaustively cover all of this, it's horrifying to me, the campaigning, the way everybody has to be shown around and the incredible number of interviews and press appearances and on ops and everything that they have to do is just disturbing to me. I wish all of that could just be eliminated somehow.
Well, I think in a part, it's because everybody's covering
Even though it's my living.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's, in a way.
Sorry.
Yeah. And I think that when you see a winner take the stage, at least for some of these big awards, what you're seeing is not only the moment where they're standing in front of everybody and they're kind of overwhelmed. And I think you're seeing the culmination and the adrenaline of 3 to 6 months worth of campaigning come to an end. And I think that's why that moment last night at the very end was so just horrific, because it is, you know, to literally be whipsawed like that.
And yeah,
talk about whiplash, no pun intended. That was Chazelle's last movie.
Well, it's also, you know, it's probably the culmination of a lifetime. You rarely get back on that stage with a Best Picture win. So, you know, that's probably it. So that's upsetting
it's
for everybody
horrifying.
As well. But it, rather than the preferential balloting, when you were at these parties and events, did you see or sense a younger and more diverse membership yet? Or does it just feel like the same people? Because maybe that's one reason why a smart art film like Moonlight triumphed.
That is possible. There is a much bigger number of international members, and they are pushing the numbers up for women. They're pushing the numbers up for younger people. It isn't dramatic yet, though. It's still small percentage points. The older white male demo still dominates. They only got rid of about 70 people with that whole thing that they talked about, you know, who were put on emeritus status or whatever. That was more ageist. That was more about getting rid of really old people who had no connection. People like Dolores Hart, the nun, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. So let me ask you this. You were backstage when Best Picture was announced in the press room. No, I would imagine, was anybody on stage in the press room at that point?
Not that I remember.
Yeah. I mean,
the place went nuts.
It was
an uproar. I mean, everybody just was like, it was like they were jumping out of their seats.
I have been in that press room numerous times. It's been a while since I've been there, but boy, I can only imagine, because it's a juggling act, trying to watch the ceremony,
right,
trying to deal with the people who are on the stage in front of you, which is not, it's not easy.
No, it's not.
And I always go back to the moment where Halle Berry won the Best Actress Award. And she's, you know, she was taking the stage, and Robert Redford was on the stage in the press room for his Lifetime Achievement Award, and he had to stop talking. And they raised the volume of the televisions because, you know, everybody was more interested in that. It was just kind of this weird moment. And I would imagine I can only imagine what that must have been like last night.
Well, as I said, the, you know, Viola was finishing up. Emma came in. Barry and his Moonlight team came in. And Damien never came back. Chazelle.
Why do you think that is?
I spoke to his people.
It's a humiliating, unpleasant
moment.
He was
overwhelmed. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to handle it. He just didn't know how to cope with it. And I think the comparison for him, all right, look, this guy is 32 years old. But a lot of people were leading him to believe that he could break records, that he could win 12 Oscars. So La La Land was sort of set up for disappointment from the beginning. And he, I think, a little bit like Jason Reitman, the year of Up in the Air, he was just crushed that he didn't go all the way and win Best Picture. It was like he couldn't be happy if he didn't.
Well, and I also think that if when the envelope was opened by Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, if they had said Moonlight at first, he could have walked
different.
He could have walked away saying it was a great night. We won 6 awards.
Yep.
I won an award as the youngest director ever to win this award.
Right.
I am on cloud 9. Instead, it's just such a, I mean, and quite honestly, I hearing some of the people talk about it now on the news and reading some of the comments. In a way, we all put ourselves in that place. What would we do? You know, how would we feel? That would be horrible if it happened to us. And it's just a everything about it is horrible. There's not anything that you could say, well, at least, except maybe the producer's response. He really did think on his feet. I don't know.
He's great.
I don't know how he was able to do it.
Everyone was congratulating him. He's like the new hero of the day. Jordan Horowitz.
Because, I mean,
in a weird way, it's made his name.
I mean, yes, I agree. I mean, as Emma Stone said, when the feeling returns to my legs, because it is this overwhelming, whenever, you know, when I get in front of 10 people, I get that kind of adrenaline rush if I have to speak. So to do it in front of, you know, millions of people and to actually have presence of mind to know what to do and when to do it and how to say it, it was pretty remarkable. And it was not his job. Somebody from the Academy should have been doing that.
Well, and Damien, to his credit, you know, when you win Best Director, it's awesome, it's great. But then when you lose Best Picture, you feel like you've won and everybody else on your team didn't win, you know, or like half the people didn't. That's an achievement for everyone. And you can all say, yeah, yes. Whereas when you've won yourself and the person next to you in your team hasn't, that feels a little bad. It feels a little awkward.
Right.
Well, and I guess in a way, it's somewhat appropriate when you think about it. And maybe that's the wrong word, but ironic maybe is a better word. When you think about the way La La Land ended, right? The movie itself, where you see what could have been, but in reality, something else happened.
A bittersweet ending.
Yes, it was a bittersweet ending where it was like, oh, you could have fallen in love with the jazz pianist, but in the end, you wound up having a wonderful career and being just as in love, but not with that person.
Very good, Sperling. I like that. I like that a lot.
I'm trying to make lemonade out of lemons here. But what I will ask is, if you're the Spirit Awards, and I know why they do this, they do it every year. They do the Spirit Awards on the beach in Santa Monica the day before the Oscars because everybody's here. Everybody's in Los Angeles. I get it. But nobody's talking about them today. And they would have at least...
Actually, I disagree with that. It looks like there's some degree of reflection between the Spirits and the Oscars.
There is. Okay, so talk about
even
that.
Even though La La Land wasn't even eligible because it was a $30 million movie and their cap is 20. Moonlight took home a record 6 Spirits, and I think the year before it was Spotlight, and there was a year that it was The Artist. I mean, they've been doing it a lot, which is good. I mean, I think it's showing what you may be talking about, which is the younger, hipper, young demo is sort of starting to make itself felt.
And so you were at the Spirit Awards, correct?
Yeah.
And so how was it this year as compared to...
Well, it was the Moonlight Love Fest for the whole day. I mean, that was the story. That was the vibe. I mean, the people in the house, in the tent, were just jumping to their feet, you know, and cheering. And it was the standing ovations for every Moonlight win. You know, it was like that.
Do you think that a part of that might be because everybody felt like, well, today is your day, Moonlight. Today, of course.
Because
I've been to those the Spirit Awards where it was like, okay.
And Isabelle Huppert won, right. Which was great, which I knew wasn't going to happen at the Oscars because of what Jimmy Kimmel said. Nobody saw the movie.
Right. Precisely.
He wasn't wrong.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what makes humor, right? When you say something sometimes that's true. Although you kind of have to be careful. I think, you know, there is a fine line.
He's going to be politically correct. That's just not what he was going to do. All right, but whatever.
I don't know. I wouldn't pick Don Rickles to host the Oscars.
No. Hardly like he was being an insult comedian, really.
Let's not go there again. Well, look, I mean, it's the end of a very long season. Are these seasons getting longer for you? Or
yeah, they do feel it. I do feel it. But hey, I'm heading for Emmys now. We make a nice. Oh, that was cool. That Viola Davis is the person who's won an Emmy, a Tony, and an Oscar. But all
she needs,
three.
She needs to get.
EGOT is the next one.
Do she's a spoken put out word.
Album.
Yeah.
And Lin-Manuel didn't get his. Aw.
Well, as you're off to Emmys, that's 6 months away, Anne, correct?
I know this begs belief, but they are already hawking us. It's already starting.
I mean,
wow.
And it'll be going on all summer long, and this is my life now. Now I switch over to TV.
Well, do you think at some point we should probably get together on one of these shows to talk about, like, how do we, I mean, you say you want it to be curtailed. I know it's your livelihood, but... For us, it's like never ending as well. It would be nice at some point we should talk about how do we change that or does it not warrant changing? But in the meantime, thank you for joining
long
us.
Long answer to that question.
Exactly.
All right. So thank you guys. And Michael, you know, keep up your ferocity.
please, but only against Jimmy Kimmel, not against you.
All right. Bye, guys. It was fun.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Well, that was good of her to join us. I just don't like Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, I always look forward to speaking with Anne the day after. I always look forward to speaking with her, period. But boy, I don't think I've ever looked more forward to speaking with her after the Oscars than this year.
Well, it's fun to get a little backstage skinny.
But we don't want our show to be as long as the Oscars, which, you know, there are times where we do push that level. And so while we had Anne Thompson here to give us, as you say, Michael, the skinny on what happened at the Oscars and what was going on backstage, and I really do appreciate that she does that. You, every week, bring us the skinny on the book industry, right? So that's so that brings us to our Book Filter segment, and Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, and every week you choose a few titles, hopefully only one this time, but a few titles that we should be paying attention to, or frankly, that Hollywood should be paying attention to, possibly for adaptations.
Right, and I'm angry at you.
What?
Yes, because last week you shamed and bullied me into not listing the four or five books that I'd set aside thinking might make good adaptations, one of which was A Darker Shade of Magic, which is the finale of a trilogy of fantasy novels begun by A Darker Shade of Magic by Victoria Schwab, V.E. Schwab. The final volume came out last week in hardcover, critical acclaim all the way through, strong reviews from readers all the way through. And I was going to say, hey, here's a great book. And I'm surprised this hasn't been already optioned into a movie if it hasn't already. And what happens 4 days after our show? Sony wins a bidding war for rights to the fantasy trilogy and Gerard Butler is producing it, and perhaps we'll star, we shall see. But in fact, it hadn't been optioned yet, this trilogy, but had great reviews all the way through. They ended it well. It's about a fantasy world with alternate Londons. These magicians can travel between the gray London and the black London and the white London and the red London, and it's got scope and scale. And I said, isn't that interesting? And for some reason, last week, everybody suddenly paid attention to this series when it ended and reached its finale with the final volume, and suddenly a bidding war broke out. So that's kind of interesting and cool. Like, a lot of books get optioned even before they come into print. Sometimes it happens, you know, at a different stage. And this one, it was three volumes into the trilogy. It ends at finale. Then suddenly everyone goes, hey, that looks interesting. So you never know when that
sort of thing
will happen.
Everyone was paying attention to it, except for us, of course.
Well, we were paying attention on Book Filter, but I didn't mention it on the show and get to look smart, you know, predicting a bidding war 2 days before it broke out. But that's why this week I'll mention three or four books that are coming out, all of which could be great projects. One of them is a history, popular history. It's called United We Stand. and it's a nonfiction look at the women's movement in the 1970s. But it's not just about progressive heroes. It also looks at how their movement for feminism sparked a right-wing women's movement and how that led to the re-energizing of the conservative movement around social issues. So it's a very broad thing. It could be really interesting. It could make a great film or documentary, or frankly, I think, a TV miniseries. You could get every actress in America wanting to play some of these parts because it's a great story with a lot of scope. And I just finished a few minutes ago The Horseman by Tim Piers, which is a lovely, quiet British novel about a lad growing up on an estate on the eve of World War I. It's the first of a trilogy, and somebody in England is going to, you know, turn this book into a lovely little film over in the UK.
I think they did. It was called Downton Abbey? Maybe you saw it.
No. It's nothing like that.
Okay.
It's not a soap at all. It's very, very quiet and gentle and observant. It's a lovely, lovely book. Not remotely filled with plot and you know, escapades. Nothing of the sort. But there is a book that could be more Downton Abbey-ish. It's called Dodge City. It's another popular history. It's about the wickedest city in the Wild West. And, you know, it's about Dodge City. It's a lot of fun. I always long for Westerns in any form. And that could be, you know, anything. A series, a movie, a TV show. Who knows? But then there's a book I was surprised about. It's called A Million Little Things. It's by Susan Mallory. She's been a best-selling New York Times author for years now, and she writes what people call chick lit, that derisive term for any fiction that's written by and about women as the central characters. And I looked at Susan Mallory because I was a little surprised to see she's never had any of her books turned into a film or a TV movie. So A Million Little Things, Susan Mallory, a very popular writer. If you haven't heard about her, you should check her out. But none of those are my picks for the big book of the week.
You mean we went through all of that and through preferential balloting, we still haven't gotten to the top pick?
That's right. My number one pick for the book of the week is Bone Box. It's an LA mystery, and it's the latest, about 24th in a series by Faye Kellerman. She's the Orthodox Jewish wife of a fellow mystery writer, Jonathan Kellerman, who's also an Orthodox Jew, as is their son, who's also a best-selling author, Jason Kellerman. They're the only married couple in history to appear simultaneously on the bestseller list of the New York Times for different books. And her series is the Decker Lazarus series, and it's about an LAPD lieutenant who solves crimes with the help of his Orthodox Jewish wife. It's a great series. There have been 24 books so far. For some reason, nobody has, you know, logged on to them and said, hey, this could be something. We should do something with this. But it's the Decker Lazarus series. The latest one is Bone Box. They've all been bestsellers. The first one was acclaimed as one of the best, you know, debut series of the year. And you should check it out.
Well, if next week somebody kind of options that after a big bidding war, that would be kind of something, right?
That's right. It would be a big deal. We'd know people are listening to our show.
Oh, okay. I think it would be a big deal for, you know, the book itself, but it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, apparently, by the way, the law degree that you and I have, Michael, the one that we got by writing in for one of those law degrees after seeing an ad on the back of a cereal box, it is actually worth something. Last week, a federal judge agreed with us when he paused the implementation of a new California law barring the Internet Movie Database from publicizing the accurate, publicly available information of an actor's age. Said the judge, "It's difficult to imagine how AB 1687 could not violate the First Amendment."
Your Honor, I object.
Actually, Michael, he's agreeing with both you and I.
Your Honor, I concur.
The judge went on to say, "To be sure, the government has identified a compelling goal preventing age discrimination in Hollywood," writes Chabria, is the judge. "But the government has not shown how AB 1687 is necessary to advance that goal. In fact, it's not clear how preventing one mere website from publishing age information could meaningfully combat discrimination at all. And even if restricting publication on this one website could confer some marginal anti-discrimination benefit, there are likely more direct, more effective, and less speech-restrictive ways of achieving the same end."
Not sure why he's a British judge.
I don't know either. I have no idea. That just came out that way. The next step includes a conference on March 21st for the parties involved. Big deal or big whoop?
So basically, they've put a pause. They said, all right, this doesn't look like it's constitutional, and they don't believe that the people who have pushed for it are going to succeed in their arguments for why it should go forward. And so that's why they said, we got to wait. We're going to, you know, they preventing them from publishing factual information is not a good thing. It could hurt the service they provide. So we all got to wait and hear the next round, but it doesn't look good for the people who pushed it. And by the way, according to Wikipedia, Judge Vince Cabrera was born in 1969, so he's 47 or 48 years old.
Twitter already has a deal to live stream football games, American football games, that is. Now, according to Reuters, baseball may be coming to Facebook, which gives live video a whole new meaning. Yes, the social media platform is talking to Major League Baseball about live streaming one game per week. And you thought the live videos on Facebook were already long and boring. Ha! Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal in a way. I mean, they just keep spreading out these sports to all these different outlets. And of course, that's always in addition to TV, right? Because they're not going to say you can only see a game on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. No, this is in addition to TV. Always in addition.
But it does make it harder and harder to figure out where stuff is. This maybe isn't a great example because it's an extra platform. But it does get a little confusing, like when you've got five different baseball deals and seven different football deals, and every night it's on a different channel. I have to tell you, though, my mom is in the Keys right now, and my sister got the newest Apple TV with the Siri voice control. My mom has mentioned this every single day. She's like, you press one button, and you just say tennis. And it finds channels where tennis is playing. Or you say Judge Judy, and it tells you Judge Judy's on a 4. Do you want us to record it? I mean, she is over the moon about this. You just press a button and you say Turner Classic Movies, and it takes you to that channel. So it doesn't matter where you're in. It doesn't matter what, you know, cable company you're using that moment. You don't have to remember anything. All you have to do is say what you want, and Siri will find it for you. And boy, does she love it. So maybe they've cracked the code for how people can interface with their TV, because whatever they got down there with the new Apple TV, my mom thinks it's the cat's meow.
So all you have to do is say what you want and then you get it?
You press one button and then you get it, yes.
I'm sure the entire cast and crew of La La Land is out there at Best Buy now trying to buy one so that they can press
it. I think it's just the channel that you want.
Oh, okay. All right. You can be racist, Michael, and spark a campaign of hate against a black woman and generally try to be as offensive as possible. In fact, that is your jam, not you, but the person we're talking about. Just don't talk approvingly of child molestation. Far-right agitator and professional dick Milo Yiannopoulos has found his book canceled by Simon & Schuster and an invitation to speak at the Conservative Political Action Conference rescinded. He's even been fired by Breitbart. Breitbart, okay? Why? It was a video in which he talked about sex with minors. Yiannopoulos claimed the videos were edited misleadingly and that if his sloppy wording left the wrong impression, he wanted to make clear he is horrified by child molestation and doesn't support it in the least. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in a way. It's just he has such a long string of nasty, divisive, hateful comments. I'm not quite sure why this is the one that put him over the top. It seemed like he had plenty of others that would be unpleasant. But my main thing is that the guy's just not worth the oxygen of talking about him. He's not important. He's not an interesting provocateur. He's not an intellectual provocateur. I don't understand why Bill Maher felt the need to have him on his show. And Bill Maher's like, see, I had him on my show, and now his career is destroyed. You got to shine a spotlight on stupidity and evilness. I'm like, okay, whatever. But I don't know why CPAC would have booked him. He's just, you know, a guy trying to get attention by saying crazy things. He doesn't deserve any attention like that.
Well, you know, as far as, you know, this goes, look, what this is saying, and this is what the internet said last week, was, look, there is a line and you can cross it. In fact, you crossed it so far, Milo, that you can't find your way back.
But he crossed it
ages ago.
20 times, yes. So I'm not quite sure why it took this particular thing to happen. Oh, well.
So Louis C.K. is doing his next two stand-up specials on Netflix. That's after he self-distributed his last stand-up special and a drama series he funded on his own. He self-distributed them on the internet. And Tracy Morgan is doing a stand-up special on Netflix. Michael's mother is doing a stand-up special on Netflix. I didn't realize that. Well, let me know when it's on, Michael. And President Trump has signed an executive order, get this, saying in the future that all stand-up specials must air on Netflix. HBO would like an injunction against that. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, but boy, are they cornering the stand-up comedy market, aren't they? My God.
Yeah, and in a way, because they have a limitless supply, or not limitless supply, but limitless inventory, so to speak. They don't have to worry about, well, we only have, you know, 24 hours in a day. We can only do 24 of these shows. They can do 500 of them and let the cream rise to the top.
HBO doesn't have that. They've got plenty of space for showing comedy show specials as well.
Now they don't
run out of space to show. There's tons of reruns on all these channels.
Right. But, you know, I've seen some nice bits on there, some nice, well, comedy and performance pieces on Netflix that I wouldn't have otherwise seen.
Right. And well, frankly, speaking of Donald Trump, he announced that he won't attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which makes sense, since why would you have dinner with the enemy of the American people, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. But what I loved, though, was the way he said it. He said, you know, I won't be attending this year. And, you know, I tell everybody I say have a great and wonderful evening. And I thought, you do realize it's not tonight, right? The way you said it, it's like it was this evening.
Why are you being gracious to the enemy of the American people?
Yeah.
But you had said, hey, I got my wish, but I didn't, because my wish was not that Donald Trump would refuse to show up. My wish was that, as I've felt in years past, the White House Correspondents' Dinner should stop chumming up to the president, because that's who you're covering.
Yeah, I think it became kind of a big television thing. And as you said, Michael, when we first talked about this a couple of episodes ago, it's you can't say no to the money. You know,
yes, you can. That's what integrity is about. That's precisely what it's about. Say no to the money when you have higher values.
I don't know what you're talking about. We've talked about how renewing a show for two seasons is the new one season renewal, right? On the other extreme, we've also discussed how networks are loath to say they have canceled a series outright. It's just not polite. You don't do that. Well, it's finally happened this season. CBS has canceled the low-rated legal drama Doubt after just two episodes. No word on where the other 11 episodes they've already made. They've already shot them. No word on where they will pop up, but it will happen sometime, somewhere, for the Katherine Heigl series. Maybe CBS doesn't need to be patient because its lineup is bursting with hits and they barely have any room for new shows. So one that isn't cutting it, well, it stands out even more. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It is the first cancellation of the season, but other shows have basically been, you know, shafted. They just haven't been official about it. But, you know, last week I happened to look at the Nielsen ratings, and I was going to mention it somewhere on the show, and no better place than here. Of the top 20 shows on the major networks, 17 of them were CBS shows.
Wow.
Including NCIS at number one and The Big Bang Theory at number two, which they're really going to say, boy, those next two seasons are the last. But ABC had two shows in the top 20 and ABC had one, I believe. And that's really a sign of the time. CBS is really dominating in the primetime categories.
Did Fox have any?
Not this week.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. I know, finally, it's like getting to Best Picture at the Oscars, you know, and this week we're not going to, you know, change topics on you. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Michael, have you noticed that because I knew we were going to talk to Anne for so long, because, of course, we always love talking to Anne for as long as we can possibly get her, that everything else that comes out of my mouth today is done in, like, double time?
Rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat-tat.
Yeah. Okay, well, this week we are talking about, really, release windows. And at least five major studios, Hollywood studios, are actively pushing a deal with exhibitors, movie theater owners, to make some movies available for premium on demand just 17 days after a movie opens. How many of these studios are doing it, or how many are serious? We don't know.
Well, it's a story in Variety by Brent Lang, and everyone's got a slightly different plan as to which movies and when, but apparently this really is going to happen because the five of the major studios are actively pushing for it. So instead of people waiting 90 days to see a movie in their homes, they may have to wait just over 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So instead of 3 months, it may be just, hey, it opened up. They will expect to have it available on demand in their homes, and they can. I'm still not quite sure who the audience is that wants to pay $50 to see a movie in their home when, frankly, $14 seems too much to see it in the theater. And I understand you can invite 10 friends over and it's cheaper. But anyway, what I want to know and what this article helped answer is, why is this happening right now?
Well, a couple reasons. We've talked about this in the past. The reason we're talking about it again is that Variety published this story and made it seem like it was imminent, or at least within the next month or two. First off, as we know, DVD and Blu-ray sales and rentals, they were collapsing, and then they stabilized a little bit, and then last summer they started collapsing again. So that's number one. Okay.
Right. Yeah. That's just that area of growth, which at one point was bigger than the box office. DVD and Blu-ray sales and rentals were a bigger source of revenue than the entire North American box office. And so, hey, now that that's gone, they're like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Okay. So that's number one. Number two would be the shelf space in stores like, well, Best Buy and Sam's Club and Costco is kind of disappearing for physical media like Blu-ray, DVDs. I don't even think Costco sells CDs anymore. Maybe they do. So if that's happening, then there's fewer outlets and fewer retail channels to sell your movies. So that's
right.
Another reason.
DVDs and Blu-ray sales are disappearing. And if there's no space to sell it to people, they're not going to come back.
Right. And now, also, there's some, and I've been saying, you know, this could be an issue for a while. You know, they keep saying, oh, well, older and older people are seeing movies. Yeah, because we're the ones who grew up going to the movies. So it almost seems somewhat anachronistic, and that's to use the term that Brent Lang used, to people who are, you know, used to everybody streaming everything on demand. So going to the movies, that's so quaint that you had to go out and do that.
But I don't know that we see particular numbers yet. That's always been a concern of yours, and you always want to teach each new generation to enjoy going to the movies.
Yes.
In a group and having that fun. But I don't see any particular huge drop-off in ticket sales among the young demo, like that they've suddenly said, I don't want to go to the movies anymore. So I'm not sure that this one is grounded. It's just a vague concern that they have.
The other, and speaking of vague concerns, certainly I don't think you or I would say that piracy is not a problem. The question is, how big a problem is it? So the fourth one that we have here is that all the studios believe that consumers, moviegoers, they want their movies right now. They can't wait. It's got to be on their phone. It's got to be on their tablet. It's got to be on their TV. And if they can't get it right now, they're just going to pirate it.
That's right. Studios claim illegal downloads are rising, but this particular article doesn't quote any stats to back that up. But as Warner Brothers CEO Kevin Tsuchihara,
yes,
told analysts this month, quote, it's about giving consumers what they want. If we don't give it to them, they're going to go to pirated versions, end quote. And that's somewhat true if you look at music, when they absolutely refused to make digital music available to people and everyone had an iPod and that's how they wanted to buy music, they started to turn to Napster. But then when you made music legally available digitally, they started to come back to buying it. You know, you do want to make it available to them. I don't know that consumers are angry and insistent that because Suicide Squad opened in a theater this week, that they should be able to get it on their phone. I don't believe that's necessarily true. I don't think 12 weeks is a huge amount of time to wait for most movies. But you want something predictable. And if they feel like people are demanding it quicker, I can understand that.
All right. So what I would say is to Mr. Tsuchihara is, are you giving what consumers what they want, or are you giving them what you want them to want? In other words, when it comes to this reasoning, I wonder if the studios want this more than the consumers. And
why do they want it? Because they're trying to, I mean, because they're just worried about the disappearing DVD and they feel like they got to replace it with something?
That's a large part of it, yes. And yeah. They make this argument about, well, the marketing, we have to market two times, yet you've had to do that for a while and it's yes, it's been kind of a pain, but it's not been an issue. Okay,
they've been doing it since the early 80s,
yeah.
And it resulted in a market that brought them a ton of money for quite a few years.
Exactly. When it worked, it was fine. Okay, so let's not get out of control. And what I would say about comparing it to the music business is that with music, you were giving people, the consumers here, a physical media that was digital, okay? And when it was replicated in a way where the quality was nearly, if not exactly the same as the CD itself. Whereas with movies, these pirated copies are often far inferior to what you can get when you wait for a legitimate DVD or legitimate streaming or go see the movie itself.
Really? Because I don't really deal in pirated stuff. Life's too short, but don't they have good quality? I would assume that once you're talking about while they're in theaters, right? As soon as Blu-ray hits the stores, then the pirated copies are good, right?
Correct. Right. Exactly. And so what I would say is really you want to get those DVDs and Blu-rays, those basically digital masters into the hands of consumers so they can rip them and then put them on BitTorrent. Really? How soon
even
do you
sooner.
Do that?
So you think they'll be able to crack the code of digital downloads, obviously, right?
Oh,
of course they will.
Yeah, you know, certainly it's already been done. So, you know, when you see the screeners kind of hitting the internet the second that the Oscar screeners go out. So it's without a doubt.
So they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot by saying, oh, we got to get this out quicker. Well, you're just going to make pirated copies available quicker.
Better quality pirated copies.
Right. High quality pirated copies. Well, what do the studios want? Warner Brothers and Universal seem the most aggressive, but Fox is also having talks and Sony's off on their own having talks. So they're all doing it and they're all interested. Paramount has already done it. They had those couple of Halloween theme movies that they made available soon after Halloween and gave a cut to the box office, to the exhibitors. They said, look, this movie's a Halloween theme movie. The day after Halloween, no one cares. Why wait? Let's collapse the window and make it available. And to me, that sort of thing made sense. You know, if you see a movie that's flopped, or you see a movie that's, it's the week after Christmas and therefore nobody wants to see it in the theaters, let's make it, why wait to make those particular movies available in the home? But that's not how everybody sees it, is it?
No, I mean, because you have the exhibitors. And the exhibitors, they, you know, the movie theater owners, they are saying, hey, why would you basically gut our industry and gut an industry that's making you $11.5 billion a year?
That's true. I was speaking more to the philosophy of these studios and what they're pushing, because some studios want practically a simultaneous release on premium pay-per-view. Why wait? That's what they say. Universal and Warner Brothers say, let's have a set time frame so people know what they can depend on. So if you open the movie on Monday, 2 weeks later, it'll be available on this premium demand. Fox and Paramount are more flexible, and they sort of follow what seems to make sense to me. They say, hey, let's just do it when the movie's not playing in theaters anymore. Let's wait. When the screen count drops down to so it's not a wide release anymore, then let's make it available to people. That, to me, kind of makes sense. It is variable. But, hey, if you've got La La Land, you know, playing well in theaters, why the hell would you want to rush it out into premium on demand? Well, so, you know, it's all a big back and forth, and different studios have different philosophies. But the basic idea is you're going to pay $50 for a premium rental maybe 2.5 weeks after it hits theater. So it opens on a Friday and then 2 Mondays later. So you have two opening weekends. You have opening weekend, the next weekend, and then the Monday after that, 17 days after it opens, it would be available premium on demand for $50. So it's came out 2 weeks ago, and now you're ready to pluck down your $50 so you don't have to bother going to the theater. And then when you do that, the studios get at least 80% of revenue after costs, because what they keep talking about is sharing up to 20% with the exhibitors. So my question for the exhibitors is, why the hell would they want to trade 40 or 50% of a cut for less than 20% of the cut?
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, the retail channel will get a certain percentage, right? So if it's
right, we're talking about after their cost of them getting it. Yeah, but they may just be a provider; they're not necessarily getting a cut of the box office. They may just be doing the work. It depends on how they set it up.
Yeah,
Screening Room is talked about as a player, but nobody wants them to have the exclusive rights.
No, and frankly, the studios don't want to give anybody exclusive rights, because then, of course, that group, whether it's Apple or Screening Room or Google or whoever it happens to be, would then kind of hold, you know, sway over the studios if it became successful. Just look at Apple in the music industry.
Like you said, it did seem imminent. The studios were going to have a deal ready for CinemaCon, they hoped, but now that's not going to happen. And now the studios say, oh no, we always wanted to go slow.
Yeah, look, you know, in a way, I read this and I thought, okay, so what is different today than, you know, after Kevin Suzuhara back in January, I think it was, did the same thing. He said, you know, or I can't remember, maybe it was December. I don't know when he said this, but he basically said the exact same thing. There's nothing different in this story than what's always existed. You got studios on one side saying they'd like to move the window up. You've got exhibitors on the other side saying, well, no, we'd like to push that out 10, 20 years, or we'd like a piece of the, you know, the digital revenue. And by the way, if it starts eating into our popcorn money, then we need to renegotiate. Nothing's changed.
I guess what's changed is that they realized they weren't going to make the CinemaCon deadline. No particular deal was going to be in place. Different studios have different philosophies, not only time frames, but what kind of movies. Some studios say, hey, this is strictly about mid-budget dramas and comedies. And others are willing to mix in a big tentpole film as well. So everybody's got a different idea about how to do this. It does affect TV and streaming packs. So it's going to have a big, complicated impact. The exhibitors are kind of very wary, as they should be. Why are we trading 40 to 50% of theatrical for 20% of premium digital? What's the point of that? But AMC is seen as the most likely to make a deal. Cineplex is second, and Cinemark seems the most reluctant. So, you know, they're worried. They want to have an escape pod. They want to say, hey, look, if it is cannibalizing, we want to pull the plug on this. You know, if it hurts us, why would we continue? And they also want something else. They say, if we're going to give this up, if we're going to collapse this window, we want to guarantee that the traditional window of about 90 days for Blu-ray and DVD and digital downloads at a regular price, that that remains in place for the next 10 to 20 years. We don't want you to come back next year and say, you know, we want to cut that 3-month window to 8 weeks. You know, they want to have some surety about all the other windows that they have in place.
Which I actually think is smart negotiating on their part.
Absolutely. They're saying, look, you know, if this starts to cannibalize box office, we want to pull the plug. But hey, the traditional window for everything else, let's make sure that stays in place, because we don't see a big audience demand for a $50, you know, 2.5 weeks after the movie opens premium digital download. And it's not a download. You don't buy it. You're just renting it for 48 hours.
That's right.
So you're saying 2.5 weeks later, you want to rent something for $50, whereas 6.5 weeks after that, you could buy it for 20.
Right.
So it's a very premium service. It doesn't, to me, I still don't see the big demand except for a movie that flops or some movie that just didn't work, because that's why else would you want to make it available that quickly in the home? And for those movies, who the hell wants to pay a premium?
Well, and for a movie like Moana, where, okay, if you bring 2-3 kids to the movie theater, you're definitely going to be paying over $50. So maybe you want to just stay home and rent it, and it goes to the TV and the kids get to watch it. There's a couple problems with that. One, you want them going to the movie theater and kind of lending it some cachet and earning more money there. Number two, for parents, it's like, what happens, you know, 72 hours later when the kid wants to watch it again? It was just on the television. Why not watch it again? Just like a Blu-ray or a DVD. Trust me, they will want to watch it again, and you won't be able to do it unless you pay another $50. So... not that that's ever happened to me before.
So this deal is not dead. It's very much active, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, look, it's always going to be active. But, you know, there are a few less people in the world who are active in the entertainment industry this week. And that brings us to our obituary section. And we have some pretty shockingly sad news. But first, we're going to talk about Judge Wapner, who, of course, here in the United States, he was the judge on the People's Court.
That's right. He died at 96, had a good full life, and he was a trailblazer. I mean, people talked about how small claims courts got flooded with people after this show aired, as they realized, hey, my little case for $200 or $500, I can go to court and get some justice. I can get, you know, I can feel like I had my voice heard. And there was a big increase in people making use of small claims court because of the popularity of this TV show, which was the People's Court, where you had a retired judge ruling on cases from real people who agreed to come before him rather than go to a real court. And it was very successful, hugely popular. And of course, Judge Judy has come in his wake. And she's around right now trying to shop the rerun rights for her TV series, which has been around for 10 or 15 or 20 years. $200 million is what she's asking for. But you know what? Her show gets 10 million daily viewers. And believe me, there's so many episodes, you wouldn't know whether it was a rerun or a new run.
Yeah, and some of the cases are somewhat evergreen, so to speak. And
what they all are. Yeah.
And while certainly, look, you know, it's sad that Judge Wapner has passed away. He was 96, though. And, you know, I think there were some people that were shocked he was still alive. For those outside the U.S. who may not know who we're talking about, you might recall in Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman constantly talking about Wapner on the floor. Got to watch Wapner. That's who he was talking about. The People's Court. So there is a reference, a link to our international audience there. But the big shocking news, I would say, is that Bill Paxton died over the weekend at the age of 61, quite suddenly, quite shockingly. I guess it was a complication from heart surgery.
Yeah, and that always scares you because you feel like, oh, you know, you go in to get a surgery, you want everything to go well. In this case, he died from complications following the surgery. No reason to believe it was anything other than simply, you know, his body couldn't take it rather than some malpractice or anything like that. But it's always scary. You know, you don't want to have surgery, and you sure as heck don't want it to go wrong. But he was a journeyman actor who sort of made it big. You know, he was in a lot of movies, just a regular guy sort of appeal. He was in Titanic. He was in Aliens. And then he got his own TV series. HBO's Big Love ran for 5 years and had a good, nice run. So, you know, he was in a lot of movies. He was in One False Move, A Simple Plan, Twister. You know, not a lot of great stuff, but he had some stuff with really good reviews like Big Love and the miniseries Hatfields and McCoys, and, you know, more power to him.
And if you really want to honor Bill Paxton and see some of his work, I would say go look and watch One False Move. It's a great movie. Now, if you want to honor some of our work, You could subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere. They offer podcasts for free. You can usually find our show. And if you can't find it there, then certainly write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. And I would like to thank Ann Thompson from IndieWire for joining us to talk about the Césars, the Spirit Awards, the Oscars, and for spending so much time with us. It was greatly appreciated. We will place links to her work and her Twitter account in our show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. You can also find our Twitter account there. @showbizsandbox is our handle on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
DownWithJimmyKimmel.com.
You just hate that guy. Unbelievable.
I have no animus towards him, but I didn't want him to host the Oscars, and he did a bad job.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, I didn't think he did that bad, but not as bad as you think he did. If you can't find any of Michael's work on that particular website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com or read some of his coverage of the entertainment industry on the Huffington Post. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.